1, 2, 3, 4. Those are numbers, but you already knew that. If you want to know what number you're going to pay each month for your car, use Kelley Blue Book My Wallet on AutoTrader. They're really good at numbers. AutoTrader.
Hi, everyone. I'm Hillary Kerr, and this is Second Life, a podcast spotlighting women who have truly inspiring careers. We're talking about their work journeys, what they've learned from the process of setting aside their doubts or fears, and what happens when they embark on their second life. Today, I am so thrilled to have Erica Chidi-Cohen, the co-founder and CEO of Loom, which is a Los Angeles-based empowered education and wellness center that focuses on everything from periods to parenting. She wants people to truly understand their bodies in a very feminist, inclusive, sex-positive, fact-based way, and I think she's well on her way to making that happen. She's also the author of Nurture, A Modern Guide to Pregnancy, Birth, Early Motherhood, and Trusting Yourself and Your Body. And she just launched a 5-part online birth course that draws directly from her book. So even if you're not in LA or you don't like books, you can still benefit from her incredible wisdom. But, of course, you know that since this is Second Life, Erica wasn't always planning on being an entrepreneur in this space. After starting her career with a stint in culinary school, she became a birth and postpartum doula before making a real leap and founding her business Loom in 2016. Moving from essentially a freelance position to running a company that offers community classes and individual coaching on every stage of the sex and reproductive spectrum is a huge leap, and she's here to tell us all about it. Now, on Second Life, it's Erica Chidi-Cohen. So, Erica, on this podcast, we like to start at the beginning. What did you study in school, and what did you think you were going to be when you grew up?
My family, well, my father and I and my younger brother immigrated to South Africa, and I completed middle school and high school there, and so I went to an all-girls Anglican school. So I think I had a pretty, you know, predictable high school education. The main difference was that they had home economics.
Really?
Yeah. So,
there's the part of me that is always like, ugh, because it was just girls who were made to take it when my mom was in school.
Yeah.
I do sort of feel like it would be a nice thing for everyone to take in a lot of ways because there's a lot of practical information in it that is actually helpful.
Yeah.
For everyone.
Totally. And, you know, I've always been a very rambunctious person. I've had a lot of high energy. You know, I was diagnosed with ADHD when I was a very little girl. I would always, like, finish my work and, like, bother everyone. And so when I was in high school, home ec was a really special place for me because it was so dexterous.
Mm-hmm.
And so I could really be kept busy. And there was a lot of focus on the outcome and perfecting it and getting more and more comfortable with, you know, making a roux for, you know, a white sauce or a bechamel or, you know, the rolling in method of like rolling fat into flour to make a scone. and I had a really fantastic home economics teacher, Mrs. King, and she really took an interest in me. And, you know, my parents had recently separated when we had moved to South Africa. And I think I was really looking, and I grew up mostly with my father, and I think I was really looking for maternal figures in different places. And she really showed up in that way. And so I loved home ec, and I really saw myself going into the culinary world. So that was kind of my thing. I was like, I think I probably want to be a chef.
So I read that you actually went to culinary school. Is that true? And if so, what inspired that decision?
Well, it's interesting. My mother went to a patisserie program probably when I was somewhere between like 7 and 8 years old. It was like a year-long program. And she would always like put on like a chefing uniform and she would go and she'd come back and like make us little paisettas and all of these different things. And so food was a very big focus in our family. So I'm first generation Nigerian American. My parents are very, my mom is a nurse, my dad's a doctor. So there's a lot of just emphasis on productivity and doing things. So I think my mom definitely influenced me. And I did go to culinary school. I went to a school called Christina Martin School of Food and Wine in Durban in South Africa. I think it's actually no longer there, but it was affiliated with a larger outfit called City and Guilds, which is a UK program, and they have all these different kind of professional courses. And so I did their 1 year intensive diploma, which was basically a 3 year course in 1 year. So I went to school like 30 days of the year or something like that.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
Casual.
Casual, relaxed. Just getting up every single day and going and doing this program. But it was good. It was kind of cordon bleu-ish French culinary kind of practices. You know, you're learning knife skills. You're doing front of house. You're doing back of house. And you're also dealing with a lot of different archetypes in terms of from, you know, the instructors and the head chef down to your kind of fellow peers. And I think that probably is what prepared me for doula work and like loom and running a business, because the intensity of the culinary world, culinary space, is an incredible skill set. You're working tirelessly. You're constantly checking things. I think, you know, when I was, one of the things when I was in culinary school that I was obsessed with, because I'm Virgo rising. I'm a Libra, but I'm Virgo rising. So love a detail and love like a process and a check. You know, you'd like go into the fridge and you'd smell all the sauces and you'd check all the dates and you'd check if things weren't right. And then, you know, on the other side, there's like deep cleaning practices, like learning how to clean a deep fat fryer and then do a deep clean on the floor, you know, and you're just like getting in there. So for me, it's like there's no task too big, too small. I don't care. And I think that came from that culinary background.
That is so fascinating. And it's true. We've had a number of people who have worked in the culinary world, some who have stayed and then some who have moved on to different fields, come through this podcast. And they all say it's like that attention to detail and teaching you, helping to instill that work ethic. I think you sort of naturally need that anyway. Otherwise, you probably get weeded out. But just having that reinforcement of process is very useful in any field that you go into.
Yeah, definitely. And I think also the team dynamic, you know, there's definitely a hierarchical system within, you know, a kitchen, and having reverence for that and finding comfort in it. I do have a lot of appreciation for hierarchy and systems.
And structure.
And structure. Yeah.
Interesting. Okay, so you didn't become a chef.
I got my diploma, but no, I didn't want to go into the industry.
So instead, you studied art history and communications. Why those areas of study, and what did you think you were going to do with that?
So I went to culinary school before I went to college. And, you know, in college, I think I found my passion for writing, and I fell in love with the humanities, as most people do when they're in college and, you know, have the capability or the permission to move into that space. And this is like a kind of stir to the side, but, you know, immigrant parents, especially Nigerian parents, like wanting to go into humanities, they're like, why aren't you just going to be a doctor? So,
and especially because both of your parents were in the medical world.
Yes.
So,
yeah. But I think, you know, I fell in love with the humanities and I really started to feel more confident in my writing. And I can't exactly pinpoint where the draw was to contemporary art and media, but it just felt like a natural fit. And I loved going to galleries and I loved going to museums. And we traveled a lot growing up. And so we were always in Europe and there's a lot of exposure. And also, as, you know, as a Black person, especially living in South Africa at the time, it was, you know, it was post-apartheid, but not that far away, probably around 10 years or so. I found there weren't a lot of people that looked like me in that space. And so I think I was curious to kind of try and take up some space within that kind of art media world.
And then I read that you worked for a contemporary art gallery and that you also worked in fashion PR, of all things. What drew you to those jobs, and what kinds of projects were you working on, and what kind of skills were you learning?
I started off interning at a gallery that started off in Cape Town. It's now called Stevenson. And I love to work. just always want to be busy. And so I felt like I wanted to try and fill my time as much as possible. So I went to an opening, and I think the first time I went to Michael's gallery, that's the owner of the gallery, there was a show by Bernie Searle on at the time, really amazing, you know, POC artist that really used her body in a very similar way that Anna Mendita did. Mm-hmm. And I loved it, and I was just like, this is where I want to be, this is what I want to be exposed to. And I just made inroads to figure that out. And I remember I was really drawn to photography, and I kind of muscled my way in, and I was like, I'll do anything, I don't mind, like, just I'll like shuffle paper. And I managed to get an internship with their lead photographic curator.
Wow.
And so the coolest thing about that is, you know, I got to have exposure to, you know, people like Zanele Mahole, who is now incredibly huge when she was just starting off with her work. And Peter Hugo, Guy Tillam, you know, David Goldblath before he passed. And Michael was such an incredibly creative and kind of, you know, strident person. And he just created this really amazing work culture where every day at 12 o'clock, there would be a lunch spread that would come out. And it was always this kind of like Mediterranean inspired. There was like baba ganoush, there was hummus, there was cucumbers, there was just bread. And he would always be like, we're having lunch now. And the day would stop and everyone would sit around this table and eat lunch. So I think he made such an impression on me. And so did my mentor, Federica, who's still one of the main curators there. She taught me so much about myself. She's Italian. She worked at Magnum for a long time. And she really helped me realize that it's okay to show up and be big. She would always say, like, you know, tap into your, like, Athena energy. Like, that's what we need in this space. So it was really formative being in contemporary art. But what pushed me to not necessarily stay in that world was I had a long-term boyfriend that I was with in college, and that relationship dissolved. And I was just like, I need something new. I need to move. I need to leave Cape Town. I need to just get out. So, you know, that led me to applying to a bunch of internships in New York. And I heard back really quickly. I think I remember the first email I got back was like from the accessories department at Vogue. And they're like, we'd love to interview you. And I was like, well, that's my ticket. So I figured it out with my parents and flew out to New York. I didn't end up interning at Vogue. I ended up interning at Alberto Ferretti. And that was a really, you know, incredible time. You know, living in South Africa, there's so much racial constriction, so much structural racism. I really felt kind of doubly othered living there because I was Black and because I was Nigerian. I wasn't, you know, South African, and I didn't speak any of the languages with any real proficiency. I definitely kind of grew up wanting my hair to be different, wanting to look not how I looked. And so I think moving to New York was this kind of deep awakening because it was so multicultural and there were so many different people that looked like me and I could resonate with. And it kind of woke me up. And I think that awakening also just led to like a lot of compulsivity and trying to figure things out and a lot of excess. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it was a really incredible year being there, but it also completely exhausted me.
I understand.
Yeah.
I did my tour of duty in New York, and yeah. I think that everyone should live there when they're young if they are able to, because it is such a magical place where there's so many opportunities and so many – you're exposed to so many things, but it also is not for the faint of heart. Mm-mm. In any way. So you moved to San Francisco, and I know that you were interested in becoming a doula and a midwife, but I have to confess my ignorance. I don't know what the difference between a doula and a midwife is. So maybe you could start there by explaining that difference and then telling us a little bit about your personal journey in the space.
Yeah. So – pretty much, doulas provide education and support, specifically emotional support for people moving through reproductive transitions. So I started off my career as a birth and postpartum doula, but I also provide doula support for people that are moving through miscarriages, abortions, so kind of that full reproductive life cycle. And in terms of moving to San Francisco and kind of finding my way to that path, as I said, when I left New York, I was pretty empty and really needed to reassess so many things. And, you know, what I realized is most of my life, and, you know, this probably has a lot to do with my family of origin and being parentified early and all these different things, but maybe a little bit of just, you know, lineage. I've always been the person people come to if something is going wrong in their life. So if they need advice.
You're the fall apart artist.
Yes, I am the fall apart artist. And I always had a lot of information about the body. Mm-hmm. And so if people had health questions or, you know, anything to do with how do I make myself feel better, somehow I was doing those things and was offering advice. And so when I was talking to my dad about it, he was like, well, what about, you know, midwifery? It's a nice combination of a lot of what you're interested in and kind of naturally talk to people about, but then it's still in the medical profession. You can still make money. Like, it should be good. And I was like, yeah, okay, that makes sense. And so we have a lot of family in the Bay Area. So I went up there, started doing all my nursing prerequisites to apply to this master's program. And while I was doing all my nursing prerequisites, I found out about doulas. And I really resonated with it because doulas are psychosocial or psychoeducational. We're not clinicians. It's like peer-to-peer counseling or peer-to-peer support. So instead of taking vitals and checking cervixes, you're looking at the whole person and you're being present for whatever's coming up and helping them get better at advocating for themselves. And, you know, I think one of my strongest skill sets is the ability to communicate with people and make people feel really comfortable very quickly. And I loved it. And so I took a training under a midwife in San Francisco at this place called Natural Resources, which I was also working at because, of course, I was like, if I work here, I can get a discount on this training.
Great. And very practical.
Yeah. And what was great is when the training was over, I was able to immediately start getting clients and I got to get familiar with all the products. And I just got to understand, okay, this is how this space, this industry works, and here's what people, you know, are needing. And what was also really interesting was that, you know, my culinary background, which I thought was like, well, guess I've got that, not sure how we're going to use it, folded in really well within the pregnancy and the postpartum kind of space because people needed better nutrition or were more interested in improving what their nutritional spectrum looked like. And so I was able to cook for my clients and, you know, take them through their pregnancies and, you know, nourish them postpartum. And so all of a sudden, you know, something that a part of me that felt somewhat fracturous started to kind of have more resonance.
It's interesting when you start looking back and start realizing that all of the disparate things that you were interested in, that they were actually pointing you towards a path that you might not have realized. So whenever I hear from people and they are confused because they've done a bunch of different things and they don't really know how it's going to all work together, I always tell them like not to worry about that piece of it. Yes, there are people who are very linear, but this circuitous route is just as valid. Mm-hmm. And in many ways, I think such an interesting way because you are able to take different pieces of your work history and your life interests and knit them together to create something beautiful, even if you didn't know that's what you were doing at the time.
When you're in it, you don't know where you're going to land. It can feel really confusing,
right?
You know, and it wasn't always on the up and up. You know, even when I was in San Francisco, I also volunteered at the Women's Community Clinic. And, you know, got a job in communications there and ended up being fired from that job, actually, because I just wasn't really capable of doing the job. You know, I wasn't actually, like, focused on it. And, you know, there's all these, like, little pitfalls that happen, like, en route to, like, figuring out exactly what you're going to do.
Let's go back to doula work.
Yes.
So for our listeners who might not know or might not be as familiar, what is the full spectrum of the work? And, like, in very concrete terms of, like, if say you take someone on as a client, what does your work together look like over the scope of a year, let's say?
So for the birth space, typically I work with people usually from around 8 weeks of pregnancy. People usually come to me really early. And we do, you know, at least a 60-minute session where we're just kind of peeling things apart and we're just seeing what's going on in your world and, you know, how you're coping, how you're not coping. And then from there, kind of adding in the education. So, you know, prior to having Loom, I would do one-on-one childbirth education with them and their partner and their, you know, or their chosen family to give everyone, you know, a better idea of kind of what to expect. I'll attend a prenatal visit with them, with their midwife or their OBGYN. Again, just trying to get more and more connected to their experience. And I really think birth doulas are, you know, we're cheerleaders. We're there to affirm your experience. At least my philosophy is that way. I think, you know, I think in the past it's changing now. There is this feeling that having a doula means, you know, unmedicated birth. It means out of hospital birth. It has nothing to do with that. I mean, for me, some of my favorite births are clients who are like, I really want to have a cesarean birth. And I'm like, yeah, that's what you need. And we're going to support you. And maybe I'm going to be the only space where you get affirmed in that decision. And that's what it's about. For me, the feminist piece around that work is how can I further affirm you, as opposed to telling you what I think is going to be best for you. And in terms of the labor and delivery, if it's a vaginal delivery that's happening, you know, in a hospital or outside the hospital, I basically am going to go to my client's home or meet them at the hospital from the time the contractions start. And I'm with them the entire labor, you know, helping them with breathing, helping them with massage, and also doing a lot of just normalizing, especially for first time pregnant people. So much of the physiological sensations that accompany birth are very wild if you've never experienced them before. It's a lot of like, is this what it's supposed to be like? I don't know if this is the thing. And so what we're doing is like, yep, mm-hmm, that's it. Normal, great contraction, normal to feel like, you know, a little out of body. So I think that's kind of what we do, is just that physical support, but then also that normalizing that helps pregnant people and couples, you know, if you have a partner, feel, okay, we've got this.
We're on this path because they've never gone down that path before if it's their first time.
Exactly.
And we, as women, I think, unfortunately, suffer from this paucity of information about our own bodies. And no matter how much you also read and try and self-educate, they're still having someone who has seen it all so many times before. It's got to be incredibly comforting. And then what happens in the postpartum space?
So in the postpartum space, the key time I work with families is between birth and around 8 weeks. That is the early postpartum shift where there is just constant adjustment. So whether it's questions about feeding, whether you're, you know, breastfeeding or bottle feeding, figuring out, you know, is this normal in terms of what your baby is doing? Because babies make crazy sounds when they get home. Their poops are crazy. You know, they need to eat all the time. And again, unfortunately, especially in America, three things. One, we're the only country where it's normalized that two people are supposed to take care of one baby. It's totally insane to me. It doesn't actually make any sense. It's not how it's supposed to be. You're supposed to have a couple of different people around helping out. I mean, when I was, you know, growing up, when my brother was born, we had someone come live with us from Nigeria just in the house, just making sure my mom was, you know, okay. So that's the one thing. And I think that's where postpartum doulas come in. We're kind of recreating that multiple, you know, care approach that was a part of our lives eons ago. And then secondly, you know, there are so many questions and a lot of them aren't clinical. A lot of them are just like sanity check-ins. Like, is this okay? You know?
Well, you're dealing with sleep deprivation.
Exactly.
Which can color your decision-making process or your reality or everything. I've never been so insane.
I mean, yeah. I mean, you don't get any sleep. And so we're coming in and, again, doing that sanity check. And then I think the other thing that postpartum doulas do is we can help, and I find I've done this a lot over the years, kind of be a mediator with friends and family. And kind of modeling for these new parents or new parent, you know, the kind of space holding and kind of boundary creation they need to make for themselves.
That's interesting because we as women often are people pleasers. Yeah. And you're taking in, you've just gone through this crazy experience personally and physically, and then you're taking in all of this outside information of what everyone else wants, and you just need to sometimes have a little help in shutting that out. I think that's an incredibly valuable service.
Yeah.
So then after you'd gone through your training, how did you start your private practice and how did you find clients? How did that business building piece of it work for you?
Well, like I said, I was working at a parenting resource store in the Mission in San Francisco. So I was able to just access, you know, pregnant people and pregnant families as they were coming in. So the growth was pretty organic. They had a, you know, a doula registry there and I was in the registry and sometimes I was in the store. Yeah. And I got pretty lucky, too, with my first birth client was amazing. But even more interestingly, my first postpartum client was a mother that had a set of twins. So I got twin immersion from jump, which was
its own specialty,
its own thing. And I was with them for, you know, almost 3 months, and it just completely reorganized how I, you know, moved into that postpartum space. And it made working with clients from there so easy because twins and singleton, it's a completely different experience. And then obviously people refer you.
So it's a lot of word of mouth.
Yes. Yeah.
I feel like that's also the most trusted way of building any brand or any company or any business.
Yeah, definitely word of mouth. I will say, though, you know, we're in a time now where branding and reproductive health, I think, have – there's starting to be more and more of a stronger, clearer, kind of more accessible aesthetic. But I think back when I started off, I really focused on, you know, and maybe this is the art, the fashion, the PR, all these pieces coming together. But I really wanted my personal brand anyway to, you know, vibrate at a certain frequency that wasn't so kind of hokey pokey. You know, the space can be super granola, which is not actually what I'm like. So I think that also had added some accelerant to my career just because people are like, this feels different and this language is different. And
well, you also have an aesthetic and a point of view, and that's very clear in everything that you've done. And I also think that's probably unique in this space. And again, speaks to the contemporary art, speaks to fashion. It's like you just were doing, it's like you were doing master's courses and everything leading up to it. It's really quite brilliant. Yeah. I was like, I know you didn't plan it this way necessarily, but hey, or maybe you didn't, you just didn't realize it. So you moved to Los Angeles.
Yes.
What made you decide to do that? And how did you know it was the right time? And what was the plan?
So met my husband in San Francisco. He was wrapping up law school. He got a job down here in LA. And that was kind of that. We were not married yet, but I would come and visit him. We did long distance for about 8 months. And I was like, I want to be somewhere warm. And it feels like something's happening down there. And so he moved and then I moved shortly after. There was not a clear plan. I was still actually on the nursing school track. I actually had gotten into Mount St. Mary's, which funny enough is where my mother went to nursing school.
No.
I know. So wild. So I'd gotten in there and I was, again, just going to keep going and kind of move through this kind of BSN nursing program. And then I...
And the BSN nursing program is a requirement for being a midwife.
Yeah. So basically I wanted to get my RN and then from there go on to move into midwifery. So that was still the plan the first year I was here. But I started kind of meeting people in the doula community, gently taking on clients. And, you know, we lived in Venice at the time. We had this bungalow in this community space with this really great garden. And I just was like, you know what? I'm going to just try this out. And so I started giving classes out of my home, making a farm-to-table meal, and thinking, okay, if I was pregnant, what would I want? I'd want really good information and something good to eat and like-minded people. And so that's kind of what I started doing, and it really caught on. And that's also how I met my co-founder, Quinn Lumberg. She was my client and my student, and then we just really bonded. And from there, you know, kind of began kind of concepting what we now have today, which is Loom.
What were some of those struggles in those early days, like as you're figuring all of this out? I mean, I think your work ethic has to be very helpful in this time, but were you having trouble with any of the business aspect of it?
Well, I think what was challenging at the time was I was still in school. Mm-hmm. And, you know, for anyone that's gone back to school as an adult, when you're surrounded by people that are maybe, you know, half your age, there's a lot of cognitive dissonance. You're like, should I be here? Like, this feels, you know, I'm like, it just felt so bizarre to be in that space and then also be straddling kind of the doula world and the kind of burgeoning kind of LA wellness world and trying to figure out how these two things fit together. So I definitely felt a lot of discomfort. I felt like I was like living two different lives, and I wasn't able to hold that very well. I think also financially, you know, doula work is famously, I think, you know, kind of underpaid. And so trying to figure out how do I make enough money with this work in order to feel like I can make a living out of it. And then also doula work, especially birth work, is grueling. You're on call all the time. It's actually, for those that don't know, it's a pretty monastic lifestyle. You don't really stay out very late. You don't drink a lot. You're kind of a light sleeper, so you can zap up and, you know, get out the house. You're gone for maybe 2 or 3 days. So, you know, all of those things together, it was hard for me to realize, okay, how is this going to be a viable business with...
And how am I going to scale?
Yeah. How am I going to scale? Definitely can't just scale by myself.
No. That's really interesting. So how many clients would you have at one point in time, too? Were you figuring out sort of the financial metrics of that as well as with your time? Because I can only imagine... I mean, babies have their own minds and decide to come when they decide to come. So you can have things planned out, but then you have... I'm sure there are lots of variables, we'll just say.
Yeah, there's so many variables. I mean, for me, I took at the top about 5 clients a month, but some doulas will do 10 births a month or more, depending on whether they're working with a partner and they're able to kind of cycle through. I always felt that I wanted to be the one at the birth. I felt like, especially with just how the medical system works here, you know, there's a lot of transient components in terms of the providers you work with. And I always felt I wanted to be very committed to the woman and to the family. So I would take less so that I knew that I could be there.
Got it. That makes sense. So then fast forwarding a little bit, in June 2016, you opened Loom as the co-founder and CEO. And I have spent a great deal of time reading about Loom. I have so many friends who are obsessed with it, but maybe in your own words, you could explain a little bit about what the mission is, what you do at Loom, and what that process has been like from starting a company.
So essentially, Loom provides empowered education from periods to parenting, where we really see ourselves going, or I would describe our core competency as health literacy and building community. That's really where we shine. Starting a business is so crazy. It's not something that you would recommend to kind of the faint of heart. But I think our mission really is giving people the capability to advocate for themselves. We're really about helping to instill and cultivate well-being through giving people the education around all of these different reproductive transitions that they're going to go through.
Got it. So was that the goal on day one?
So the goal on day one, I think when Quinn and I were out the gate, was focusing on pregnancy and parenting. But what was interesting, and when I say out the gate, this is probably a year and a half before we opened. We were just like, pregnancy, parenting, let's go in, let's go hard. That's going to be our core demo. And as we got closer to opening, I don't have children. I will someday. But I realized that there definitely was this gap around just sexual education.
Totally.
And reproductive education. And I, you know, I would realize how few people knew anything about their menstrual cycle, knew anything about birth control options, had even a slightly positive frame of mind around themselves as sexual beings. And so, you know, I was like, okay, let's just throw in one more pathway. We'll just call it periods for now, and we'll build out something around that. And so I kind of created this curriculum that was just centered around reintroducing people to their menstrual cycle for those that are currently not cycling using hormones. And so what's been interesting is cut to now, it's one of our most popular classes. Our periods and sex classes are always kind of gangbusters. There are the two of the classes that I teach. And I think going back to your question about the mission, for us, we want people to stop compartmentalizing reproductive experiences. There's no reason why sex and periods needs to be divorced from parenting and pregnancy. They are inextricably linked. It's totally, you know, conditioning and society that has divorced those things. And I think the other kind of central component is the kind of divorcing of pleasure from all of those experiences.
Absolutely.
And so I think a primary goal for us is to reinsert pleasure, reinsert levity into these spaces, and then encourage them to kind of come together, which is why the aesthetic, the language, the feeling of Loom, it looks the way that it does, because we do feel that there's a barrier to entry to this really fundamental, you know, information when a brand doesn't look or feel right. And so, you know, our feeling is make it feel good. And then people are going to be like, oh, this is kind of cool. I do want to go to sex class. I do want to go to a birth class. Why not? It seems nice there.
So how did you hit on this specific aesthetic? And how did you know that the brand as a whole was coming together in the right way, so that it was the mission made sense, the look and feel made sense, the, you know, social media, the physical space, that everything felt cohesive and all moving in the same direction that you wanted it to go?
Well, I think one of the things we really focused on was hiring other women. So it's essentially an all-female team pretty much to this day. I remember there's certain places in L.A. that I really loved going to. You know, I always loved the store. It's no longer here, but 10 over 6.
Yes.
And years ago when Sarah Gibson Tuttle opened Olive and June.
Yes.
Loved that space. And what was interesting about those two spaces is they're both kind of created by the same person. So a very incredible woman, Brady Cunningham, shout out. and another incredible woman, Katie Burgess, they are behind a design firm called for Apricots. They also have 6 children between them, all under the age of 10. And, you know, I remember reaching out to Sarah when I was starting off, you know, just thinking about the aesthetic. And I was like, I love what you've done here. You know, could I, you know, connect with Brady? And, you know, she made that introduction. And then we found out that my co-founder, Quinn, you know, through her circle also was already friends with Brady. And it was just this kind of synergy of just like, okay, that is exactly what needs to be happening. Everything was in concert. So I think that just made the work so much easier in terms of concepting the space, you know, because we went from a very raw, rubbly, nothing going on space to the space we have now. And I trusted them and I admired them. And, you know, I think
that's key for any sort of partnership.
Yeah. And it's the same thing with my co-founder, you know, with Quinn. I trust her. I admire her. And I think that's how you hire. That's how you grow, I think, is seeking out that type of energy. And I'm also not a micromanager. You know, I love like the highest and best talent and just letting them kind of do their thing and then providing some buffers here and there. But I want anyone that's on our team to feel like they can stretch out and explore. And if we need to create some containment, we will. But, you know, you got to give them some runway.
How did you fund Loom in the beginning and find partners who would work with you at, you know, who would work with your budget?
For no money, basically.
Yeah, right. So, I mean, but that's part of it. It's like that's part of being a founder is you have to be resourceful.
Yeah.
And use connections, use things, make smart choices, figure out where to spend money and where not to spend money. So how did you figure all of that out and how did you fund the company in the beginning?
So the first round of funding was friends and family. So we haven't done a seed or a series A, and we, you know, had very little going into it. And that automatically motivated me particularly to give people the opportunity to invest in the mission. Because our goal and our focus was that we really want to improve people's lives. We really want to give people better health outcomes. We really want to empower women, people in their bodies. So I feel like a lot of people were able to onboard around that mission. we also realized that we would not have any money for traditional things like marketing or PR. We knew that the space was the most important thing. So that's really where all of our capital went into. It went into hiring an architect. It went into the design team. It went into everything that was needed to make the space what it was. In terms of the curriculum and all of that, that all that IP was within me, so we didn't have to pay anyone to do any of that. And I did all the teaching initially.
Got it. Well, you've done an amazing job with that.
Thank you.
So inclusivity is a huge part of what you do at Loom, and you have a whole set of classes and program called KIN, mm-hmm. which is for your LGBTQ+ community. Why was that so important to you?
So, you know, I identify as a queer person, although I've settled in a hetero partnership. I have a lot of empathy for same-sex people that are trying to conceive. I'm also a Black person. And, you know, I was saying this the other day, I realize, although I am a marginalized person in this country, I have a modicum of privilege through the ability to be a owner and have a business. And so, you know, I feel that it's my responsibility, and I know Quinn feels similar, it's our responsibility to use whatever privilege we have to create more accessibility. And so, you know, my understanding was that people just didn't have spaces to talk about, you know, the wins and the failures and the challenges of trying to create a family when you are, you know, a queer person. And so it's been a really wonderful offering. There's so much alchemy just in sharing space with people and talking. Nothing's being fixed. It's just that permission to emote is really profound. And I think, you know, beyond the kind of LGBTQ+ space, our inclusivity is around just the reproductive experience. So we talked about different kinds of doula work a little earlier, but another kind of doula work is supporting people through miscarriages, through abortions. And we have really focused on creating conversations and creating support groups around miscarriage and abortion as well. Because for us, we really think that that separation and the kind of shame conversation that takes place around those two experiences doesn't service anyone. And especially for me, I see abortion as health-seeking behavior. And so our feeling was anyone should be able to come to Loom and not feel excluded, to feel like there is something there for them, whether it's a periods class or a sex class or, you know, an abortion support group or a mommy and me. You know, it all lives together. The person can be sitting in a mommy and me class and have gone through all of those experiences. So I think for us, that's the inclusivity piece, is you can bring all of your parts here.
The whole experience
yeah.
of being a human.
Yeah.
So you also wrote a book.
Yeah.
Because you don't have anything else to do.
Yeah.
Called Nurture, A Modern Guide to Pregnancy, Birth, Early Motherhood, Trusting Yourself and Your Body. And that came out in October 2017. What was that process like?
So this is little known, but Loom opened in October 2017. Mm-hmm. I think we opened on the 3rd of October, and the book came out October 24th of 2017. Relaxed, easy, swimming, no problem.
Yeah.
So almost lost my mind in those kind of 3 months, because for those, anyone who's ever written a book, you know, you have pub date plus 3 months to just like do the pony show and make sure the book is out there. But I also was teaching every class, making sure everything was working at Loom.
Being a co-founder, being the CEO.
Yeah. Being a partner, being a wife, being a human. So it was really wild. I will say this about the book process and, you know, and the launch of the book. I always knew, and my book agent said a similar thing, you know, the book would have a long life because it's more of a tome. It's an evergreen concept. So, you know, as much as I was like, okay, I need to do X, I need to do Y, because that's what you do to promote a book, I found some comfort in that, okay, if I can't smash this right now, I think I can keep trying to come back to smash it for the next 10 years.
It'll still have legs.
It'll still have legs. So that was helpful, but I definitely felt, you know, it was such a split imperative. And the book very much was just me, whereas Loom had, you know, my co-founder, our team, a lot embedded there. And so I really, in some sense, I would say almost kind of decided to forsake the book and focus on Loom. So it's been really fun, actually, in the past, say, 6 or 8 months or so, because the book has just really had this really amazing impact. And I'm actually releasing an online birth course based off of the book, which is really fun because the question that always comes through to Loom on our DM or me or just friends being like, oh, I wish like you were like in Austin, or I wish you were in New Zealand, or I wish I could just gift you to my friend. And the online course, which was such a labor of love, feels like that. It's a lot of how I show up for my clients or how I teach my classes, but in this one-to-one dynamic. So I'm excited to see kind of how that impacts the life of the book, and then also just excited to reach more people just through that video medium.
That's incredible and a great way to scale. So one of the things that we like to talk about on this podcast is the fact that many women out there, many people out there might be in a chosen field that they enjoy, but maybe it's not their calling. Maybe they think that there's something else that they should do, but they're worried about changing lanes for some reason or another. As someone who has changed lanes a few times and probably will continue to as we continue down this path, because I feel like we all contain multitudes. What advice would you give someone who's interested in switching or evolving their career?
The best advice I would give is to metabolize quickly and early that it's going to feel gross. You're going to be like, this is terrible. I don't feel like myself. I don't like it. You're not going to feel fully realized as you get ready to change lanes, as you're changing lanes, as you're in the lane. It's all going to feel kind of yucky. And I think we as human beings don't like that feeling. We kind of want to do everything possible to get away from it. So, you know, instead of making that huge leap, you might make more of a mid leap just so that you can kind of pacify the feeling of like, I don't really want to feel this uncomfortable. So my encouragement would be try not to pacify, try to just go for it and accept the discomfort that comes with it. And on top of that, don't take a bigger leap than you're able to concretize yourself around, right? So you need to have savings in the bank or take out a loan like I did. I think I took out 2 loans between, you know, the kickoff of concepting Loom and opening to pay for legal fees and all these, you know, wild things that you need, or just being able to not work for a second to be able to, you know, do what needs to be done. So, you know, as much as it's like take the leap, but take a calculated leap, it's okay for your changing lanes to be phasic. It doesn't have to be like, whoop, here I am. It can be like, here I am, and here I am again. And have a good inner sanctum, you know, have people who are going to be real with you and like call you on your shit, and, you know, maybe people who can validate you. You know, there's a really great quote the other day that my friend Layla posted on Instagram. Forgive yourself for the relationships that you accepted when you weren't in your power. And, you know, when you are making a life transition, sometimes you're not in your power and you're going to collect a lot of energy around you while you're trying to create this new infrastructure. So I would just be really mindful of the energy you collect and try to see if you can create an inner sanctum that's actually truly supportive and reflective of you. And also understand that as you grow and change, so will your needs, so will your preferences. And those relationships might change too. Those relationships might fall away. And that's actually okay. You know, I think that's something that I hear a lot of people talk about, like as you grow in your career, your ecosystem can shift a little bit. So when I mentioned the idea of an inner sanctum, that inner sanctum can have variability. It just always needs to be there. And whoever is in there needs to really be affirming of you.
I love that. So we talked a little bit about the online course. What else are you working on that we should look forward to?
We're really excited right now in terms of Loom. We're about to head out into the wild, wild world of actually fundraising.
Exciting.
Yeah.
Now is a very good time.
I know. That's what I hear. Because we want to expand and create a digital platform and be able to reach
Loom
more people.
Loom for all.
Loom for all. Loom everywhere. So to try and take the health education as far as it possibly can go. So, yeah, we're currently ideating around that.
Well, it's very exciting. My last question is also my favorite question, and it is this. Erica, if you could go back in time and speak with your younger self, what advice would you give her?
I would tell her that it's okay to just have a lot of interest. I always had, and I have less of it now, but I had a lot of shame around all the different things that I could do. I always sometimes wished that I was just good at one thing and could kind of stick with it. I think that probably came from my parents like wishing for more kind of stick-to-itiveness from me. I think I would have told her that it's going to be okay, that it's fine for you to bounce around. Like, all this bouncing is actually a really good thing. It's going to help you be able to have this kind of prescient ability and disrupt a space that needs to be disrupted. So I think that's what I would tell her. And I also would tell her that it's okay to cry and feel your emotions. You know, I think when you are in this entrepreneurial space and we're like, you're smashing it, you're killing it, you're getting it done. And also, I think as a Black woman, there is definitely this feeling of there's no room to unfold, break down, disclose, emote. And, you know, that's something I'm really encouraging myself to do more and more of. And I would have loved to have heard that more growing up.
Erica, thank you so much. This was so inspiring. That was the CEO and co-founder of Loom, Erica Chidi Cohen. For more inspiring interviews with women like Erica, head on over to secondlifepod.com. If you like today's show, please subscribe on iTunes or Apple Podcasts or Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to rate and review us. I recently just read a bunch of your reviews and they mean so much to me. I cannot thank you enough for being so kind. We love seeing you spread the word on social, and you can tag us in your posts. We are at Second Life Pod on Instagram and Twitter, so come say hi. We always want to know who you'd like to hear from on the show. So if you have a great idea, send in your requests to hello@secondlifepod.com, or you can DM me on Instagram. I'm at Hillary Kerr, or you can DM the pod at Second Life Pod. It's really up to you. I'm Hillary Kerr, and you've been listening to Second Life.